This is the Recent Interview with Nick Gillespie. Thanks for listening. Pano Canolis is the president of the University of Austin, which will be admitting its first class of 100 students this fall. The college was founded in 2021 as an antidote to left-wing monoculture in academia, and it's committed to free speech and the pursuit of truth above all else. I spoke with Canolis, a Shakespeare scholar and first-generation college kid who grew up in a Greek diner in Chicago, about how the University of Austin will be different from virtually every other college around, why the humanities have virtually disappeared from higher education, and how a chance encounter with Nobel laureate Saul Bellow changed his life. He also does a quick, improvised, close reading of the poem Ovid in the Third Reich by Geoffrey Hill, one of his major intellectual influences. Here is the Reason interview with Pano Canolis. Pano Canolis, thanks for talking to Reason.
Thank you for talking with me. It's a great pleasure to have this conversation.
Okay. Well, I'm going to be talking at you.
Just take it. I'll take it.
In a 2021 piece for the Free Press, when you announced the creation of University at Austin, you talked about how America is filled with broken institutions, and that higher education might be the most fractured institution of all. How do you hope the University of Austin kind of knits those bones back together?
Yeah. I think what I meant when I said that of all institutions, higher ed is the most fractured is that it might be the institution that has become most separated from its traditionally understood purpose. We've traditionally understood universities to be institutions dedicated to the pursuit of truth above all else.
Mm-hmm.
And, that should be the operating system of a university, the pursuit of truth, not necessarily the acquisition of truth or the transmission of truth. Mm-hmm. Truth is a difficult thing to apprehend, but the pursuit of truth. It seemed to me that for many institutions, that was no longer the primary priority or focus.
Mm-hmm. What replaced it?
Well, I mean, if you follow Jonathan Haidt, mm-hmm. Haidt would say it's a pursuit of a kind of what he would call a social justice agenda,
mm-hmm.
I would even extrapolate more broadly and just say certain kinds of agendas
right.
that, sort of whether it's to make society better, to engineer a different sort of culture, to intervene in social relations between mm-hmm. people, whatever it is. I do think that many, if not most universities, feel that they have a kind of ethical obligation to follow those pursuits parallel to the pursuit of truth, in place of the pursuit of truth, above the pursuit of truth. I mean, I think that's a conversation to have with each institution.
Right. I'm thinking back, and as I walked in the building, and this is a great great floor that you have. Mm-hmm. I know you have 100 students in the entering class, right? Will they taught here?
Yeah.
But what I was saying, and your assistant gave me great directions and said, okay, enter, it's between Velvet Tacos and Ruth's Chris Steakhouse. And what I loved about that, it reminded me, I went to Rutgers as an undergrad, and for the first couple of years, it was a colonial college, started in 1766, and the first several years, and quite possibly the last several years, it was held at a bar. It was a Dutch Reformed seminary, but it's like, universities often start in very kind of, strange circumstances and things like that. But most of the colonial colleges in America, or the older colleges, were seminaries. So they were in pursuit of, a very kind of particular religious truth, depending on what church or what faction was doing that. And then at some point in the 19th century, maybe after the Civil War, they were both truth, but then also like pragmatic, the land-grant colleges and the Morrill Act and all of that. And then it seemed there was a moment when we were modeling our universities really on research universities, and we were looking for the truth of the natural world, as well as maybe some private spinoffs or products and things like that. And certainly, I think when you and I, and you are 54?
54.
Okay, yeah. When we were going to college, that was part of the selling point, right? Like you didn't necessarily go in order to get a good job on Wall Street. You didn't, you went to study stuff and be knocked, you know, have your socks knocked off by literature or just right. things you didn't know existed, right? So when do you think that the truth agenda or the wow agenda really of like coming face to face with, you know, the greatest that has been thought and said kind of went south?
I mean, it's hard to pinpoint something in particular. I guess, mm-hmm. I guess in terms of the general trend, I would say, this is going to sound like a very modern thing to say to apply back to medieval mm-hmm. universities, but I think the universities, at least in the West, have always been about preparing students, graduates, mm-hmm. for the knowledge economy.
Right.
And what I mean by that is just preparing them for work that is primarily intellectual in nature. In the medieval university, the kind of the origins of Western universities, the knowledge economy was really narrow. It was you were going to do theology, law, or medicine. And that was sort of the scope of things. As the knowledge economy began to expand in the West, I think the relationship of universities to society at large changed. The footprint of universities became larger and larger. Universities throughout most of the past millennium were essentially eccentric places, places where very few people attended. And the people who attended there generally were privileged, and they weren't attending universities necessarily to access power or to, you know, to find ways to better themselves financially. They usually had those things already. So they were, you know, sort of peculiar kind of places mm-hmm. where society did its thinking on the side. And if you were there, at least ostensibly, the idea was you would sort of pick up the habits of what we would now think of as critical thinking, pick up the habits of scholars and deep thinkers. And somehow this would leaven the culture, having people who were in positions of power, people who were wealthy, sort of tempered by an education. I would say, you know, with the advent of the dominance of the knowledge economy, and wherever you want to, you know, sort of think about that, starting late 19th century with the rise of the Research One University mm-hmm. is probably a good place. Universities became much more central. Mm-hmm. It became much more important for somebody who was had intentions of being upwardly mobile or being included in what we would think of as the kind of the prestige economy to go to universities. And so the instrumental nature of universities preparing graduates for, you know, let's say a greater range of roles and more specific roles in a knowledge economy, I think really changed the character mm-hmm. of these institutions.
So let me first ask then, how, you know, what does the curriculum at University of Austin look like? You know, does it resemble a typical university where students will have a major, a minor, et cetera? What are the core classes or the required classes?
So let me start by saying something that's going to, among many other things I say, probably get me in trouble.
Okay.
And it's certainly the last thing a college president should be saying. But I think that the university education in the United States goes on for too long. Mm-hmm. I think 4 years is excessive for an undergraduate degree. And I'm going to back into the curriculum in a minute.
But okay.
I think it's
no,
it's,
and you're also right. I mean, globally, yeah, we're an outlier.
The standard is you know, 3 years is the mm-hmm. global standard for undergraduate degrees. Mm-hmm. It's one of the reasons why university education is so expensive. I mean, mm-hmm. if we cut it down to 3-year bachelor's degrees, mm-hmm. you would reduce the cost of an education in half, because not only would a quarter of the, you know, sort of you directly save a quarter of the cost of education, but that fourth year you would most likely be in the workforce and generating income. So first of all, I think it's 4 years is too long. And I think that's obvious because at most institutions, we fill those 4 years with lots of really unnecessary things. You know, sort of endless strings of electives that are really untied to anything else. And
They're there mostly so that departments, various departments in a university are kind of getting a shot at the students.
Well, they're there because the accreditors demand that we have essentially 120 credit delivery system.
Right.
That's what universities are. We're 120 credit delivery systems. And you know, that's much more than you need to deliver a major or even two majors or even a major in your general education requirements. So you have to fill in the space with something.
Right.
So, but I can't do anything about that. I mean, we're a four-year university in the United States.
And you're accredited, right? Are you working towards that?
We're accreditation. Yeah. We're chartered and authorized in Texas. We're a degree-granting institution, so I have to play by the rules.
I've been told in Texas, though, you're not allowed to field a football team for at least 10 years or something like
that.
That
is a gentleman's agreement that the president of the University of Texas and I have, that we will not have a football team.
You know, sometimes it seems as if the University of Texas doesn't field a football team either. So
I'm going to stay out of that. They're my neighbors and friends. I'm not getting into any of that. But you know, back to the 120 credits. So here was one of the things that we were thinking deeply about when we were starting university and the curriculum. Is like, okay, look, we have to deliver 120 credits. Can we divide that experience up differently than other four-year institutions? Or can we provide a series of different types of educational experiences that would add up to something that was more substantial than the traditional model? And what would those look like? So it kind of the solution is either really, really, really too simple or very elegant. I don't know which one it is. But I said, well, let's take each two-year segment of the 4 years and think about it, you know, as a sort of separate experience, as a separately tailored experience. So at University of Austin, for the first 2 years, students are primarily engaged in what we call our Intellectual Foundations program. And this is, you know, pure liberal arts program. You know, it ranges from philosophy to literature to mathematics to the fundamentals of science to musical theory. And the real focus is to ask the most important human questions in a conversational Socratic setting, and to think about the answers to those questions from as many different disciplinary angles as possible.
I get, because I was a English major for many, many years, I understand what that looks like in English. What does that look like in a math class?
Yeah, so for us, math, what we would call math is what we call quantitative reasoning.
Okay.
So what is, like, how do you reason in a quantitative fashion? In other words, how do you use math, how do you use the principles of math to think philosophically or even pragmatically, as opposed to just learning how to do problem sets or something like that? So that's, you know, again, it's thinking about, look, at St. John's, where I was before, did this beautifully with math. They began, you know, they began with the very, at the very origins of geometry. You know, and rolling back and you know, the thinking of the very, very first question that began the field of geometry, the opening question was, what is a point? And that's a philosophical question. Is there such a thing as a point? And then you start building the system of geometry from there outwards. So thinking about the conceptual, let's say, underpinnings of mathematics or science, that's what's really essential in a liberal arts setting.
Right.
So for the first, you know, for the first 2 years, students, again, are primarily engaged in Socratic discussion and big questions. The very first class they take is, where do ideas come from? And there are classes on the sublime and the beautiful and the origins of politics and totalitarianism in the 20th century. And you're thinking about big ideas and big questions as a foundational experience and as a kind of, let's say, sort of in the sort of deepest sense, a traditional liberal arts experience. In the latter 2 years, students, rather than have a conventional major, they join one of our, what we call centers for academic inquiry, which are thematically based. They join one of these centers as a junior fellow. So the centers are places where scholars and practitioners are engaged in high-level intellectual work that has a kind of, let's say, pragmatic or real-world orientation.
Can you give an example of what that will look like?
Yeah, I, you know, so, you know, for example, we are, rather than have something called a major in aerospace engineering, mm-hmm. all right, we are partnering with a local aerospace company to prepare our students for what we call on-site immersive learning. So they'll take courses that will be designed in conjunction with our partner that will prepare them to do the kind of work that you would do as an aerospace engineer, but they start engaging in that work on site, even as they're doing their coursework.
Right.
All right. So you have, on the one hand, a very traditional liberal arts approach to education. On the other hand, a kind of immersive, pragmatic approach to how do you take knowledge and activate it in the real world?
Wow.
So it's, you know, theory into practice, you know, knowledge into action. That's the general, let's say, the arc of one's time at the University of Austin.
What so am I right that I forget where I read it, but that there's 100 students in the freshman class? What's the profile of them? Who are they? Why did they choose here as opposed to the various places that their parents might have gone?
So we're still in the admission cycle now, mm-hmm. so the class is emerging. So I can give you a partial profile.
Okay. Yeah.
Let me say why we chose 100. For the first class in particular, we're looking for students who are more interested in building a university than going to a university. Mm-hmm. And we tell them that. So you're going to be the very first class at a brand new university. You're going to roll up your sleeves and you're going to help us create the culture, the academic culture, the student culture. You're going to help us think about the direction that we're going in as a university, help us understand how we can live up to our principles.
And I'm wondering if Pharaoh said that, you know, you're going to help us build the pyramids. Right?
I don't know that I love that analogy.
No, but that's very exciting. So I know I've read that when you said, okay, you know, we're going to start staffing this goal and I'm going to get to the composition of the faculty shortly, but, you know, you had like tens of thousands of people or something, you know, saying like, yeah, I want a teacher. I want to hear about that. So, yeah, where, you know, I mean, this must be, you must have an incredibly, low acceptance rate, I'm assuming.
Well, at this stage, I'm told by my admissions people not to say too much in detail because we don't want to discourage students. But I'll say at this stage for those 100 spots, we have over 20 students applying per spot.
Wow.
And our admissions is continuing, it's rolling. So mm-hmm. I don't know where we're going to end up.
Yeah. But what is there a common type, who are the people that are coming in?
You know, I would say they're probably a couple different types of students are coming in. What they all have in common is that these are students who are, interested in, you know, not necessarily the road less traveled, but mm-hmm. the road still being built.
Yeah.
Right. And so that's a particular kind of character, which I think matches powerfully onto the character that many young people have today, which is that they see themselves in the world as having to be builders and creators and innovators. Young people today don't expect the institutions that have traditionally been where graduates end up to be there, to be ready to receive them mm-hmm. anymore. They feel like they have to make their own way in the world, that they have to kind of construct their own pathways.
Are you practicing any kind of affirmative action? And by that, I mean, you know, regional, gender, or, you know, like how, because this is like a big deal, right? And you want to have good people. I assume you want to have a spread. I'm curious, reading up on you, you are the first generation of your family to go to college, right? Yeah. And is that a consideration, or are people like that coming in, or have, you know, what goes into who gets the fat envelope?
So no affirmative action whatsoever. Okay. In fact, the Constitution of the University of Austin prohibits mm-hmm. us from taking any kind of characteristics of any sort. Religion, national origin, political beliefs, mm-hmm. Anything into consideration as we're admitting mm-hmm. students. What we are looking for are curious students who evince a kind of nimbleness of mind and an openness to a culture of civil discourse and persuasion. Mm-hmm. So that's, you know, that's the character type we're looking for. you know, we ask them, tell us about a time in your life when you changed your mind about something mm-hmm. very important.
Yeah.
How did that transpire?
And that, I mean, you know, part of what the University of Austin is speaking to is a kind of stultified, repressive campus culture, which I'm sure is also filtered back through high school, you know, if not middle school and grammar or whatever, elementary school. You had a couple of summer sessions already, right? Or kind of proto classes and things like that. And that was modeling that as much as anything else, right? Absolutely. The idea of like, you know, how do you disagree civilly and then hopefully get to something closer to the truth? How did those go?
They went phenomenally well. I mean, we've done them two summers now. We call them the forbidden courses, mostly because it just sounded cool. And we brought in, you know, really kind of heterogeneous group of faculty, you know, people like, you know, everybody from, you know, Walter Russell Mead to Katie Royfe to Mark Lilla, you know, to Deirdre McCloskey. Mm-hmm. I mean, it was a really varied group of people who were teaching the seminars. And, you know, we had no idea. We were inviting students from other universities. So these are current universities. We had no idea how many students would be interested. So the first summer, I think we had 80 spots and the applications were in the thousands. Mm. And interestingly, they really skewed towards elite institutions, which mm-hmm. it's a data point. Maybe that means that, you know, students at elite institutions feel less likely to be able to express themselves and mm-hmm. students at other institutions. I don't know, but that was a data point. And many, many international students. So the students came, the conversations were phenomenal. I mean, almost every single student who attended told us that this is what they thought college would be like.
Can I ask you, are you in a way, this is like a grift because all you're doing is offering people the college education that everybody, and I like you as the first person yeah. in my family to go to college. Like, that's what you thought college was. You have this experience of wanting to be in a room where suddenly right. all of the kind of earth-shaking, mind-shattering, you know, truth of the past and of the future comes together.
Right.
I mean, how, you know, I guess this is a much bigger question. You know, how did our existing institutions of higher education, and particularly the elite ones, how did they lose that threat?
Well, as you might imagine, it's something I think about a lot.
Yeah.
I mean, I've spent my whole career in higher education. Look, I think the seeds were planted for this back when universities moved towards the research model, mm-hmm. which meant that, you know, in the kind of university research model, research is understood to be the collection of data and information about the world that can be tested, verified. You test, create a hypothesis, you test it, you verify, you publish the results, and you have a kind of quantitative approach to the advancement of knowledge, which works wonderfully for quantitative disciplines, mm-hmm. disciplines where you can measure things. But it doesn't work so well for qualitative disciplines. In other words, the humanities. Mm-hmm. And most of the social sciences.
Right. Although the social sciences for decades now have been trying to ape the methodology of research science to be more real, right?
And I think that's where I'm going with yeah. this is sort of the methodologies of the research of the hard sciences started to be adopted by the social sciences, which then bled into the humanities.
Right.
So the idea that you had to have a hypothesis, you had to have a theory about something very important, and that you would use your subject matter to test and prove that theory. So, you know, this is, you know, the sort of origins, let's say, of critical theory, mm-hmm. critical theory in the broadest sense, whether you want to use a particular kind of lens on the world, a feminist lens or, you know, a Marxist lens mm-hmm. in that, to sort of, you want to use your discipline to sort of prove whether or not the Marxist hypothesis or the mm-hmm. feminist hypothesis is valid. And suddenly literature got tangled up in this kind of
yeah,
stuff
sure.
and other, you know, and other, you know, the arts
when
and
were
the
you,
history.
Your PhD is in literature, right?
Yeah.
When were you in grad school?
So I was in grad school from, I did a master's degree around 95, 96, okay. And then and finished my PhD in 2002.
Yeah. Okay. So this was in the thick of things.
But I wasn't in an English department.
Right.
I was in the Committee on Social Thought at the University of Chicago, which is interdisciplinary and distinctive and you know, mostly resistant to that kind of theorizing.
We'll come back. I want to talk about your intellectual kind of genealogy, both as a student and as an academic. But just to finish the thread on what University of Austin looks like, how much does it cost?
So I believe very strongly that one of the reasons that we've seen higher education decline is because the financial model of higher education doesn't work. And universities become vulnerable financially and therefore end up compromising their principles out of a sense of financial exposure vulnerability. So it's very important to me, to those of us who are affiliated with the University of Austin, to create a financial model that works, which includes a reasonable and transparent tuition. Mm-hmm. So, I mean, I'm not going to lie, kind of cheekily, when we decided what our tuition was going to be, I said, well, what's Harvard's? Let's do half of that.
Yeah.
Because I know we can deliver a high quality 4-year private degree for less than half of what they deliver. Happened to be about $32,000. So Harvard was around 64 when we asked that question. So I said, okay, let's design a 4-year private bachelor's degree at $32,000 a year, which is still not nothing. I mean, that's still that's not cheap. But again, private institutions are completely self-funded. The revenue comes from tuition. But if you set those kind of boundaries around it, you can create an institution that has to live within its limitations. So so tuition is $32,000 for our first class. Although I will say, the first 100 students, we have already raised full 4-year tuition scholarships for them. So they will be receiving full scholarships, but the tuition is set at 32, and it'll probably be the same the following year for the next class.
Let me ask, I know Barry Weiss. I've written for the Free Press. I know a variety of the people who help fund the university, as well as the scholars who are early on, people like Steven Pinker. You mentioned Deirdre McCloskey and whatnot. A lot of people will say, this is a right-wing institution, or this is a right-wing reaction to what is perceived, rightly or wrongly, as a kind of, left-wing takeover of the academy. Is this a right-wing institution, or is it a conservative institution even? Or how would you respond to people who are like, this is ideology, an ideological reaction masking itself as something else?
I mean, look, we believe in ideas, not ideology. Ideology is the death of ideas. And so, I mean, it is true. I mean, higher education has tilted in the extreme to the left. I mean, that's incontrovertible. And that's one of the problems in higher education. Not that it's tilted to the left, but it's tilted at all. In other words, it's tilted so far that it becomes the kind of intellectual pluralism that you need for a properly functioning university isn't available at most institutions. The greatest mistake we could make would be to tilt the university to the right.
So who are the faculty? And from what I've read, there's no tenure here. What are the terms of employment? Are faculty expected to do research, or how does that kind of stuff work?
So, yes. Yeah, so the faculty are, we've received thousands and thousands of inquiries from prospective faculty, and we're in the process of hiring our first cohort of faculty who will begin in the fall. They, on paper, look like faculty at other institutions, PhDs, prestigious, degrees from prestigious institutions. They have, most of them have significant experience. But I think where they differ is that the faculty we're hiring tend to have, rather than have research be the kind of their exclusive and primary focus, the professional focus, they're deeply interested in participating in a community where the life of the mind is what's first and foremost, which includes scholarship, but also very importantly includes teaching. It also includes creating a community of intellectuals, students, faculty, people in the public and that. And so already what we're seeing is a kind of very vibrant, intellectually pluralistic community forming. You know, and I think the one characteristic that all of the faculty so far hold in common is a kind of ferocious attachment to intellectual openness and open inquiry. Like they're just, that's what they're seeking. They're seeking an institution that won't compromise in those areas. Yeah.
And I'm assuming you kind of have your pick of the litter. There's a lot of academics who are, you know, who are extremely high functioning and everything, and they're just kind of like, I can't stand my workplace is terrible. Yeah.
I mean, I can't tell you how many stories I've heard from other academics that accord with that. I will say we're not looking for discontents. We're not looking for people I want to get out of my institution because it makes me miserable. Right. We're looking for people who have a positive orientation towards this pursuit of truth. Yeah. And people are like, look, I want to be unbounded. I want to be able to ask questions that maybe other people aren't interested in, or maybe, you know, other people aren't eager to hear questioned. I want to hear from other people. I want to be, you know, invested in persuasion and not coercion. These are the kind of things we hear, but we're really looking for just people who are really alive to ideas and so in love with ideas that they just can't imagine not taking ideas in every possible direction.
What's the terms of the contract? Are they on renewable multi-year contracts or?
So one of the things—
And I guess also, how will they be evaluated?
Yeah, so we don't have tenure. Mm-hmm. And I think part of the reason for that is actually, I think tenure has come to restrict academic freedom. I mean, the whole idea is that tenure protects you and, you know, and you can't be fired if you—
Yeah, I mean, anybody who either is getting tenure, has tenure, or had tenure knows— It's not about academic freedom.
It's not about academic freedom. In fact, it's about the opposite, because the way the tenure system works, tenured faculty decide who gets hired and then who runs the gauntlet of the tenure track and then who gets tenured. So the whole system works towards ideological conformity, right? So you want a career, you know, you got to please people who have stature and power in your field. Yeah. And so you sort of shape yourself in that direction, and then you kind of go through, you know, go over the hurdles and that, and then maybe you get tenure. By that time, the people who are tenured are mostly people who agree with each other about most things. So academic freedom isn't, you know, it's not a fertile ground for academic freedom. So, but I do think that faculty need to have their academic freedom preserved and protected. So the way our system works is you have 5-year contracts. The terms on the contracts are agreed up front. These are the courses you're going to teach. You're going to sit with the provost or with your dean, and you're going to say, okay, over the next 5 years, I'm going to embark upon these projects, scholarly or otherwise. Mm-hmm. Everybody agrees that's what you should be doing. At the end of 5 years, if you've done what you said you're going to do, you're renewed. Mm-hmm. And so, you know, it's a very simple and transparent process. Everybody knows what their responsibilities are and what the possibilities are. One of the nice things about this process is that it gives academics the ability to shift their focus over their career. You know, we're very open to what scholarly endeavors, scholarly achievement might look like. And so, you know, you might be a scholar like I was a scholar of Shakespeare and early modern drama.
William Shakespeare?
That guy.
Yeah. Okay.
And you might be a scholar of that and, you know, and be writing articles and books and working for 10 years as I was in my early career and then decide, you know what, I'm really much more interested in theatrical practice right now and I'd like to do some directing and I'd like to do that. You have the freedom to do that in the system. You just make sure that everybody agrees that that's what you should be pursuing. Now, to protect academic freedom, we have in our constitution, we have, you know, our founding documents are formatted as a constitution. We've created, unlike any other university that we know of, something that looks like a Supreme Court or a judicial branch that deals with issues related to the mission of the university and academic freedom. We're convening what we call the Adjudicative Council, which is a group of 7 scholars and intellectuals who are outside the institution, who volunteer to form this council, this adjudicative council, who are there to hear any challenges that anybody might bring forth on issues related to academic freedom or, let's say, mission drift of the university, the constitutional principles not being upheld. And the university is constitutionally bounded to the findings of this group. Yeah.
So are the people who are on that, have they been selected yet, and are they publicly known?
We're in the process of selecting them. In fact, this spring, we're having what we call our first principles summit, which we do every spring to talk about how we can live up to our mission. And that's we're gonna form the adjudicative council at that summit. So we're still looking at candidates for that. But what's important about this is to create an institution that's held accountable to its values, but that has a mechanism for accountability that rests outside the power structure of the institution.
Yeah, that's fascinating. Do you think that'll catch on, or is that part of the hope that you guys are, you know, starting an outpost here that will then wash back into the existing academy or prompt other kind of startup universities?
Oh, absolutely. I mean, I think this particular governance structure, and we've had conversations with people, lots of other institutions already who are very interested in it. This could be revolutionary in higher education. And I think it will be adopted by other institutions at some point because it just solves so many of the problems we have. Right now, at most institutions, if there's a conflict about, let's say, the orientation of the institution, the mission, the principles, it's just a, like, you know, Hobbesian power struggle. You know, it's between trustees and faculty and, you know, donors and students, and everybody's hashing it out. And there's not a very, let's say, objective way to determine whether or not an institution is doing what it was intended to be doing. So creating a third-party assessment mechanism is really, really important. So we do hope that this is a model that will be adopted elsewhere. We also hope that other institutions will form in the wake of, you know, the formation of the University of Austin and create, you know, more heterogeneity across higher education.
Let's talk about your kind of history, intellectual and otherwise. I mentioned you were the first person in your family or generation to go to college. Grew up Greek American in Chicago.
Yep.
You were expecting to run the family's diner, or your parents wanted you to do that.
Yeah.
You went to Northwestern. And I read an anecdote where you didn't really know much about how things worked. So your roommate told you, you got to pick a major. You ended up majoring in literature?
I did. I was in English and creative writing.
Yeah. How did that come about? Why that as opposed to everything else, you know, that a university has to offer?
Well, the reason I went to university was I just loved to read. I mean, I would sit in the back of my parents' restaurant and just, you know, I spend my days in books. And so my assumption was that's what you did at a university.
Right.
You know, you go, you read, you talk about things. I really didn't know. I didn't know like what different disciplines were that you can major in particular things and that it was meant to add up to something called a career. I just didn't know that. And so I just naturally gravitated towards the major that encouraged me to read as many books as possible, and that was English.
And then you went to Boston University for a master's?
Yeah.
And also in English?
Not exactly. It was an interdisciplinary program called the University Professors Program, which was a fascinating place at the time. I mean, it had people, Eli Wiesel was teaching there, Derek Walcott, Roger Scruton, Jeffrey Hill, a really fascinating faculty. And I've always gravitated towards interdisciplinarity. So I've never been comfortable in these kind of siloed disciplines. And so I was there expecting to do my PhD. I started writing my master's thesis on Hobbes' Leviathan and ended up moving on to Chicago after that.
You had a kind of fortuitous run-in with Saul Bellow at BU that led you to the University of Chicago. What happened?
So At the time, Bellow was new to BU. He had been at Chicago and the Committee on Social Thought there for, you know, decades. But he had moved to BU, and I think it had something to do with they offered his wife at the time a job in Chicago, and I can't remember. And we were at an event. There was sort of this weekly seminar where the graduate students and the faculty would get together to hear a lecture, and that was followed by lunch. Mm-hmm. And you know,
and that explains why all the grad students were there.
That's why the grad students were there. And I happened to sit next to Saul Bellow at lunch and was chatting with him, and he asked me about my work, and I said I was writing on Leviathan and liberty and authority, and he seemed interested, and we talked and talked for quite a long time, and everybody else had filtered out of the room, and it was sort of just the two of us. And he looked at me and he said, "Why are you here? Why are you at Boston University? You should be at the University of Chicago in the Committee on Social Thought." And that, to be honest with you, that didn't seem like something that was in something that would be possible for me. You know, I was just, again, a kid from the back of a diner, and like Chicago just sounded so grand. And
right,
and
that's where Leopold and Loeb go.
Well, that's right.
Not Pano Canelli.
Yeah, exactly. So I didn't think much of it, but he did. You know, he took down my name, and a few days after this encounter, I got a call from the secretary in the Committee on Social Thought, and I ended up going to Chicago to mm-hmm. do my PhD in the Committee on Social Thought.
Yeah, and you, what did you write your dissertation on?
So I wrote primarily on Shakespeare. My dissertation is really on memory and memory in the early modern period. The centerpiece of it is a kind of close reading of Hamlet. But the dissertation range, again, I don't like to be contained. I mean, I started writing, the beginning of the dissertation is about, you know, Plato and Augustine, and it ends up with Nietzsche, and sort of in the middle there is Hamlet. But it was really about memory and modernity, the role of forgetting in the kind of, with the advent of modern consciousness.
Mm-hmm. You, as an academic, then you taught at a variety of places, including places like University of San Diego, and did theater work there,
yeah,
right?
Correct.
And then one thing before you got to St. John's College, a great books program where you were president, you taught at a thing called the Honors College at Valparaiso University in Indiana. Can you explain what that was and how did that, it sounds like that was the one kind of public university that you taught at.
No, Valpo's actually private.
Oh, it
it's
is
a Lutheran
private.
University.
Okay.
I've never taught at a public.
Okay.
So it was a place called Christ College, was the Honors College. And it was an Honors College. You had to apply in advance of attending the university, or accepted separately to the Honors College. And it had a kind of great books core set of courses. So you would be in the Honors College, but you'd also be majoring in something at one of the other colleges at the university. And before that, I had been at Loyola University that has a beautiful honors program there that also begins with this kind of year-long march through the sort of Western intellectual tradition. And, you know, to me, this was, I think, one of the reasons I've been attracted to those kind of, you know, those kind of large scale, big idea programs.
Is it because you're trying to bring it back to the Greeks?
Of course. I mean, obviously, you know, I don't even know why we study anything after the Greeks, but I think it's just because, you know, like I grew up without that. Like I didn't have that. I didn't have access to these books and this history and these ideas when I was growing up, because, you know, again, I was growing up in a household that, with parents who didn't have the privilege to be educated, you know, and so it just felt to me like there were so many things out there that I should know that I didn't yet know. And every time I'd be exposed to an author who just filled in another piece of the puzzle, it was such a thrill. It still is a thrill. Yeah. I still experience that now.
And then you became president of St. John's College, which is arguably the best. I mean, I guess Chicago helped kind of create the great books framework in American universities. St. John's is arguably the best known kind of instantiation of that. Let me ask this. Why do you think places, and I know a bunch of people have gone to St. John's College, and it isn't like people are monks and they're like, you know, reading these ancient texts and you don't really discuss them. You just let them wash over you. They're vibrant, revisionist, fascinating kind of places. Why are great books programs seemingly conflated with the most mummified, stuffy, boring approach to, you know, a small set of works that is never changing?
You know, I think I think if you reframe that model of education, not as great books education, but as education in the great conversation, you think differently about it. The idea that there's a conversation that's been going on as long as human beings have been using language that essentially asks the same kind of questions over and over again, like, who are we? Why are we here? What are we meant to do? You know, what is beautiful? What is justice? You know, like thinking about these questions and the books that we read in this tradition are, you know, some of the most compelling and profound answers to those questions. Books that often disagree with each other, so they're never final answers. So if you think about it as this kind of ongoing live conversation about the deepest human questions, trying to explore the kind of fountainhead of the human experience, it seems as fresh as anything could be, because we still ask those questions. We're still looking around and saying, why are we here? Like, what is the meaning in that? You know, so understanding it properly, I think you understand there's nothing antiquarian about it. I do think for people who think it's antiquarian, they, you know, many people think maybe we don't need those answers anymore, or at least the answers that have been presented in the past. We have different answers now, and the answers that we have now are better than the ones who have come before.
Yeah. Well, it seems to me there's two primary kind of attacks on the conversations, you know, the great conversations. And one, which I think many of the people who know University of Austin who might read the Free Press and whatnot will say, well, we know what it is. It's that a bunch of people who are bent on overturning Western traditions, however they define those, are doing that. And, you know, you look at Plato and Aristotle and Shakespeare, you know, they're all dead white men, et cetera. And that the canon doesn't allow for participation by, you know, people who only recently in an American context have been admitted to the university. That's one sign of attack. The other is in a society that says, why would you, you know, especially if a college degree costs $200,000, why are you reading books when you should be studying accounting or engineering and things like that? How do you respond to that? Like, how do you, because I mean, you talk a lot about the liberal arts, and you obviously have a great belief in the relevance and the meaning of the humanities. You know, how do you critique those critiques?
Well, I'll start with the second one. Yeah. You know, I think going back to the notion that we're preparing graduates for the knowledge economy, that the work that they're going to do, the work that most college graduates are going to do for the rest of their life is work of an intellectual nature of some sort or another, manipulating language or symbols and analyzing, critiquing patterns. Yep. I mean, that's just what it is.
Right.
That's what a liberal education prepares you to do. Higher education isn't necessarily about content. It's about, you know, strengthening the muscle of the mind. Mm-hmm. All right, creating deeper and more profound ratiocinative prowess. The content is interchangeable. So, you know, the idea is, you know, when we say we're preparing students for the intellect, the knowledge economy, what you do is you think about it, you take a young person and you actually have them leave the kind of quotidian world and you put them in these sometimes Arcadian settings. Mm-hmm. Where they have 4 years to think and write and read, and hopefully they're taking advantage of that. What they're really being exposed to is a place where knowledge is created, where knowledge is discovered, where knowledge is advanced, where knowledge is preserved, where knowledge is transmitted. And spending time in those places, they pick up the habits of knowledge creation, knowledge discovery, of being able to you know, again, kind of manipulate symbols and interrogate language. They're even if they don't become scholars, scholars are the people who do this their entire life. Their proximity to scholars, their work with scholars, or they're taking a dive into the courses that they have there is preparing, let's say, their mental architecture for the things they'll do for the rest of their lives.
Right.
I mean, the truth is very few majors actually correspond to an actual job.
No, and it's kind of like you know, businesses should train, or they're going to train their whoever they hire.
Right.
But you need to be able to think, right?
You have to be able to think, and you have to be able to, and you have to be able to question. You have to be able to have a kind of mental nimbleness. You have to be able to look at things from many different angles. You have to be able to exchange ideas. You have to be able to have conversations with people you disagree with, not to sort of win an argument, mm-hmm. but to try and find out what the deeper truth might be. And so spending time in an environment like this, I think is transformative. And so that's what you're carrying with you into your career.
God, I hope so. And now address that kind of more, I'll say left-wing or identity-based critique of a kind of great books program or a liberal arts education.
Yeah, I think, look, if what one expects is that, you know, you're going to go to college and you're going to read a bunch of books and those are the only things you're going to read for the rest of your life, then the books you read there are it's really high stakes. Like, this is all you get. And so if I'm only going to get these 200 books and they're all written by dead white guys, this is going to somehow malform me.
Right.
Right. But if you think of it as, you know, exploring the, let's say, the intellectual tradition of the West as a foundational experience that's going to help attune you to the ideas that really do drive the world. I mean, our mm-hmm. ideas about liberty or about justice or about consciousness or about whatever have really been shaped and formed by a relatively narrow band of thinkers. You can understand the genealogy of ideas, and you have the rest of your life to go exploring mm-hmm. in any direction you want, to push against those ideas, to find other authors, to read in other cultures. You know, the true intellect is rooted and reaching. But you need that rootedness because, I mean, the truth is the ideas that dominate us. I mean, just think of the forms of government we have, everything, you know, from democracy to autocracy. These are all forms mm-hmm. of government that have been, that the Greeks talked about centuries ago and that have been instantiated in one way or another throughout the history of civilization. Understanding that genealogy is just important to understanding who we are today. Mm-hmm. And then that's the launching pad, you know, mm-hmm. So if you think, if you have a very narrow view and you're like, your education is that thing that's boxed in those 4 years, I can understand why you might want to swap out some of the books because mm-hmm. that's all you're going to get. But if you think of it as being, you know, foundational, as being what's going to set the stage for your further intellectual growth, you may never want to read a book by a dead white guy again because mm-hmm. you've read them and you're done. Right. That's great. Right. Or you may want to go back again and again. That's up to you.
It is fascinating how a lot of people, you know, both conservative and, you know, progressive or however you want to split it, really seem to act as if, you know, you have kids for 4 years and like, and then they're never going to read again or whatever. So like you have to pump them full of the right information because it's got to last them a lifetime.
Yeah. And I think if that's what you do, you've horribly failed your students. Yeah. What you should be doing is not filling them with information. Education is not, it's not about the transfer of information, it's about transformation. So you need to be transforming them into heat-seeking missiles of truth.
Right? This, you are sounding dangerously like Paola Freire against the banking model of education, which I think is absolutely correct, right? You know, that these are not empty vessels who get filled with wisdom and then go out and dispense it, but rather you're turning them on to stuff.
You're activating in them a hunger, a desire. And, you know, I mean, you know, Plato said education is fundamentally an erotic activity. It's about igniting a kind of passion. And it should be a passion for learning, for getting to know the world better, getting to know ourselves better. And you've succeeded if a student leaves university feeling like they've learned almost nothing.
Yeah.
Then you've succeeded.
As long as the check clears.
As long as the check clears.
Yeah.
Now, if they haven't learned anything, that's a problem. But if they feel like they haven't learned anything, in other words, if they realize like they've just scratched the surface of what's out there and then they have that passion to continue, that success.
I remember during grad school for English, like there would be people who like never thought to read off the syllabus. And I was just like, why are you doing this? If this is the limit. I want to put you on the spot because you had mentioned that one of your person who had a very big impact on you was Geoffrey Hill when you were at Boston University's the late British poet. And he's known for many things, including, you know, his work. It's kind of like he's known for kind of dense prose where everybody has to, like, you read his book with Wikipedia or read his work with Wikipedia open so you can understand it. He's known for a poem called Ovid in the Third Reich. And I was wondering, can I put you on the spot as a literary, somebody trained in literary analysis? Can you do a quick, close reading? I'm going to read the poem very poorly. It's only 8 lines long, but it is incredible.
You're going to leave the Latin out?
I am. You know what? I was taught Latin by a nun who, a Catholic nun who was in love with the Roman gods. And as a result of that, I don't speak or understand Latin, but we'll leave it out. But it opens with something from Ovid. Can you paraphrase the...
Yeah. I mean, the opening from Ovid, and this is why it's important, because it's Ovid and the Third Reich, is, you know, my Latin's terrible, but it's essentially, you would translate it as something like, he who denies having sin has not sinned. Only confessing your guilt makes you guilty.
That's right. Yeah.
And so, you know, think about that in the context of the Third Reich and the, you know, in the concentration camps.
Right. And I think it's important. Then, so the poem is in this, I'll put a link in for people following along at home. I love my work and my children. God is distant, difficult. Things happen. Too near the ancient troughs of blood, innocence is no earthly weapon. I have learned one thing, not to look down so much upon the damned. They in their sphere harmonize strangely with the divine love. I and mine celebrate the love choir. This is an intense poem. Can you, like, how would you walk students through this to, you know, kind of get into it?
Well, I mean, for me, the way that I normally try to get into poems, any kind of literary artifact, is to look for something that seems like a rupture, something that seems unexpected. Because if, you know, when something, all art is a negotiation between expectation and surprise. Mm-hmm. So finding moments of surprise are very important. And the very first line, the enjambment is really interesting. The first line of the poem is, I love my work and my children, period, God, next line, mm-hmm. is distant. Mm-hmm. That's a radical rupture, right? I mean, just syntactically.
Yeah.
I mean, it takes a sentence and it separates God, that's a subject of that sentence, you know, from is distant, right? From you know, from the verb and from what predicates that. And that to me itself indicates a kind of a rupture, a kind of tension, mm-hmm. right? I mean, first of all, it evinces what it says. God is at one end of the line and is mm-hmm. distant, is all the way at the other end of the line,
right.
Even though syntactically, grammatically, they should be side. Mm-hmm. So something has come, something is separating God from something else. And I think that's where the poem enters. And I think you have to start thinking about, well, you know, what is creating that, you know, that, let's say, spiritual, psychological reality. It's very interesting as well in that first line that the poem begins with I. Mm-hmm. So the first word in the line is I, and the last word is God. So the speaker himself is separated from God by work and children. So you start to get a sense of, like, what it is that might be coming between us and the divine. What kind of there's some sort of commitments that come between us, some sort of attachments, the things that are ours. It's my work and my children, mm-hmm. separate us from the divine, from God. And I think that's, you know, I mean, that's, you know, how I would start to get into this poem, thinking about the context generally. I mean, I think people forget that titles are parts of poems.
Yeah. Oh, yeah.
And that, you know, oftentimes, you know, we sort of think of the title as just a label, but in fact, the title in many cases is laying the table, mm-hmm. You know, and so there's a tremendous gap between Ovid and the Third Reich.
Yeah, can you briefly explain who Ovid is?
Oh, I mean, you know, a Roman poet, who you know, was famous for many things, but in this particular poem, is being his amores are being quoted, which are poems about love and seduction. And when you think about that, you know, this brief 8-line poem mentions love 3 times. I love my work. Then lower down, they in their sphere harmonize strangely with the divine love. I in mine celebrate the love choir. What a strange conjunction. The idea that a love poet and the concept of love is being mashed together with, you know, the barbaric and, just radically inhuman activities of the Third Reich. How can this be? How can human beings be capable of being loving beings and also being beings that build and populate concentration camps? So this is a poem of intense, I would say, dichotomies, and uncomfortable ones. So, I mean, this is how I would get into this.
Yeah, no, and thank you for that. We'll leave it there, but I hope that people get a sense of this is what, you know, you are bringing at University of Austin and what the humanities can bring, that, you know, the beginning of an exploration of meaning and a construction of meaning and getting at better or worse ones of that with, you know, the liberal arts.
Well, I'll qualify what I just said in a way. Mm-hmm. You asked me what I thought. In the classroom, the last thing that I would want to do as a teacher would be just to explicate a poem like that.
Right.
You know, I might get the conversation started by pointing to something. But a true Socratic experience, a true liberal arts seminar, is conversational. And the ideas should be ricocheting around the world. There shouldn't be a sort of single source of authority. The only source of authority should be the text itself, the text on its own terms. So as a teacher, I just committed a cardinal sin as a teacher. I went too far. What I probably would have done is just pointed out something very simple at the beginning and just asked the question, you know, why does the first line separate God from the rest of the sentence that follows? Where do we begin there? And then I would have tried to shut up.
Yeah.
And
which is always hard to do.
So hard to do.
You know, I suspect, just as a quick final topic, if the humanities were taught more in the way that you were just discussing them, they might be doing better. A good friend of mine started teaching at Duke in the late 80s. And when he started, they had 1,000 English majors. They, when he left there for another institution a few years ago, they were down to about 50. That is dramatic, but it is a widely observed pattern among many disciplines in the humanities. What do you think, what's the primary cause of the, you know, kind of flight from the humanities? And, you know, what's the best way to stanch that?
I mean, I think it's something like what I just said. You know, I think the primal sin with students is telling them what to think as opposed to asking them what they think.
How to think.
Or how to think. I mean, in English departments, the humanities in general, because of the rise of this kind of seductive thing called theory, what students are often asked to do is simply put on a kind of a set of glasses and read through a particular lens. I mean, theory really comes from the Greek theorin, which is to see. They're basically told, this is how you will see this. You're going to put on this sort of theoretical framework, and your job is to read the text through the lenses of something that's been predetermined. There's nothing intellectually interesting about that. It just becomes a kind of crossword puzzle in a way, and you're just filling in the, you know, the boxes as appropriate. And because it's not intellectually interesting, it's not interesting to young people. So, you know,
I might add that is not always, I mean, that's a sin, I think, that somebody like Harold Bloom commits as much as, you know, Gayatri Spivak or something.
Yeah.
You know, when you reduce kind of the text to a problem to be solved. It's or something to get so you can get on to the next one. It becomes complicated.
I mean, texts are problematic, which means they're filled with all sorts of problems.
Right.
And mining those, I think, is very, very interesting. But again, I think just following things that seem to be noteworthy, following those gaps, following the sort of organic questions that emerge, I think are really fascinating. My whole dissertation, I told you earlier, I wrote on Hamlet. The origin point of my dissertation was I was in a class and I was reading with a wonderful professor who happened to be not a literary scholar, but a poet, Mark Strand. We were reading Hamlet, and we noticed that, you know, when the ghost appears to Hamlet, to his son, he says, you know, Hamlet, remember thy dear father's death. Remember me. And Strand pointed out that in the earlier version of Hamlet that was staged by, that had been written by somebody else, the most memorable line from that play, the only thing that survived, was the line, Hamlet, revenge thy dear father's death, revenge me. And I thought, what an interesting shift. Shakespeare took a very famous line and changed revenge to remember. Why? And that for me opened up a whole, you know, I mean, just a world of questions. And those questions led me on actually to go very deep into the play and then later on in the idea of memory itself. You know, and that's the kind of, that's what the humanities, that's what liberal education should be sparking, as a kind of sense of openness and curiosity and exploration. And if we recovered that in the humanities, I think many students would be much more interested in studying English or philosophy or the arts than we currently find in universities. They want to range freely. They want to ask important questions. Now, of course, you always have to remember that I say this in class all the time. Every idea needs to be heard. Every idea also needs to be backed up by evidence. That's right. The other piece of it. Yeah. You can't just have ideas and feelings. You have to find a way to justify your opinion as best you can.
Yeah. All right. We're going to leave it there. Pano Canellis. Canellis.
Oh, great.
Thank you so much, founding president of the University of Austin in Texas. Thanks so much for talking.
Thank you for this conversation. I'm so grateful. And thank you for bringing Jeffrey Hill's poem to me today. It was wonderful to do that again.
What I love about his work and I don't know it that well, it's just like, okay, now this, the shorter the poem, the more you research. It's fascinating.
Yeah, it is indeed. Well, thank you.
Thank you. This has been The Reason Interview with Nick Gillespie. Before you do anything else, please go to Apple, to Google, to Spotify, to SoundCloud, wherever you get your podcasts, and sign up, subscribe. Don't miss a single episode. Or make it easy on yourself and go to reason.com/podcast and sign up there. You can sign up for our other podcast series, including The Reason Roundtable, the SOHO Forum Debates, Just Asking Questions, Why We Can't Have Nice Things, and even The Best of Reason, where a robotic AI voice trained on Catherine Mangu Ward's vocal utterances reads new great stories from Reason. So go to reason.com/podcast and sign up. Subscribe to all of them. Thanks for listening.